Welcome to Latino Sutra, the podcast that celebrates the stories, achievements, and experiences of Latino individuals making waves in their communities and beyond. I'm your host, Victor Escalante. And each week, we bring you inspiring conversations with trailblazers, innovators, and everyday heroes from diverse fields, all united by their heritage and their drive to succeed. Whether you're looking for motivation, insight, or simply a reminder of the incredible power of the Latino community, you've come to the right place. From entrepreneurship and activism to arts and academia, we cover it all. So sit back, relax, and get ready to be inspired by Latinos Who Thrive. Today, we have a very special guest, Dr. Baeza Ventura. She is the Deputy Director of Arte Público Press, Co-Director of the Latino Digital Humanities Center at U of H, and Associate Professor of Hispanic Studies at the University of Houston. Dr. Baeza supervises the team of designers, copy editors, proofreaders in the production of some 30 books per year, and plans and administers Arte Público Press digital humanities services and products. Arte Público Press was recently awarded the BANF Award for its leadership in publishing Latino literature both locally and nationally. We're going to tell you how you can have your book published if you have a book in you to be able to tell your story. So let's get on with it. And now we have Dr. Gabriela Baeza Ventura. Welcome, Dr. Baeza.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here with you today.
It's quite an honor to have you as a guest because you're a distinguished intellectual Latina in the Houston area. You are the head of Arte Público Press, and you recently received an award, which we're going to talk about a little later. But tell us, Dr. Baeza, where are you originally from?
So I'm originally from La Frontera, from the border, from Ciudad Juarez in El Paso.
I lived in El Paso for 10 years.
That's wonderful. It's a beautiful place to be.
It's a very beautiful place. Other than the 2 weeks with the dust storms, it's a great place to live. Although I hear that it's even gotten even hotter.
It sure has, yeah.
I taught at UTEP, and I was also in media at Univision Radio in a couple of stations in Ciudad Juarez and taught at El Tec de Monterrey in Ciudad Juarez.
Really, that is really cool. That's great to know. I always run into people that have, you know, lived in El Paso or have been in El Paso that are doing, you know, that have been doing like a lot of creative work from El Paso. So it's I see that as something that's always a plus.
Yes. So it's we have that shared experience in common to talk culture and to talk literature. And to talk your area of expertise. So tell us, Dr. Baeza, you're a distinguished Latina here in Houston. Tell us the through line of how you got here.
So I came to Houston through my graduate work. So I came to the University of Houston as I was pursuing a PhD in Spanish literature. I had previously, you know, gotten a degree from the University of New Mexico. On Spanish literature, and I really wanted to come to UH to pursue, you know, continue to study Spanish literature as I had in a very traditional setting. And so when I came to the University of Houston, I was given the opportunity to work as a research fellow at Arte Público Press. Arte Público Press is the Recovering the U.S. Hispanic Literary Heritage Program. And in that program, I had barely like seen some of its publications, but I wasn't really like fully aware of what the program was doing, and which it still continues to do. And the program is an arm of Arte Público Press that seeks to document to identify, document, and make available the written legacy of Latinos from colonial times until 1980. And so I became a research fellow in that program, you know, searching for like anything that was published in the U.S. by Latinos in Spanish. And then I also worked as a person who had to extract the literature from the newspapers that were assigned to us. So we would be assigned a newspaper from El Paso, for example, El Continental, and you had to read like the entire newspaper, you know, from the front page to the last page, you know, for all the different years that it had been published, and extract everything, anything that was considered literature. And to us, literature was a very open topic, right? And open genre. So letters, jokes, you know, literary news, anything related to any author was extracted. You know, you have to fill out a page, you know, the title, some sort of description. And so being, you know, working in that program gave me a very important sense of the production, the literary production that Latinos were involved in the territory that we now know as the U.S. And because those newspapers were documenting and showing, right, that Latinos were writing, were publishing, they were writing in English, in Spanish, in languages, and also in, you know, in Ladino, in French, and they were writing about their experiences in the U.S. And this was something that I had never ever been exposed to until I came to the University of Houston. I eventually selected a topic from there to continue my dissertation, and then that's how I became faculty in the Department of Hispanic Studies here at the University of Houston, and then also the editor at Arte Público Press.
What was your subject of expertise that you chose for your dissertation?
So I chose to study crónicas or chronicles that were published in the newspapers on women. And these were like satirical commentaries that were often written by mostly men to make fun of how women were becoming too Americanized, right? There was one writer, for instance, whose name was Jorge Ulica. He used a pseudonym. His name was Julio G. Arce, but he published under the name of Jorge Ulica. And he wrote several, you know, a bunch of crónicas. One of them was so funny. It was called Mrs. Payne's Flowers, Doña Dolores Flores, right? And it's this woman who changes her name from Mrs. Payne's, from Dolores to Payne's, because she wants to become very American, and she makes her family, right? She not only changes like her own identity, but she begins to change things in her home so that her entire family is Americanized as well. And so my goal with this dissertation topic was to study the way women were represented in these chronicles, and they were made to be seen by the general audiences as the ones who were guilty of the Americanization of the Mexican populations that were living in the U.S.
Was the writing fictional of that particular author,
yeah,
or was
fully it fictional? It was fully fictional, but the crónica, the chronicle, the genre itself is based on reality, right? On lived experiences. And so,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So what era are we talking about when this author was publishing Las Crónicas?
Between 1920 and 1940, 1950.
Now, let me ask you, have things changed?
I don't think so. I don't think a lot of those things have changed. I think women still, and that's still one of the topics that I've been very focused on in terms of like gender and you know, in women's studies and in literature, and especially Latino literature, because Latino literature and a lot of the literature is based on you know, on lived experiences and where authors are trying to document and to showcase, like, are they're being influenced by what is by the social environment that surrounds them. And a lot of times, oftentimes, women are often, you know, targeted, the beings who have to take care of culture, right, and keep the culture active and keep all the elements that are tied to our Latinidad intact, right, or to our ethnic identity. So if we're Mexicanos, right, we're going to continue to do the same thing that we did as Mexicans, following all the traditions that we came with, especially for immigrant communities, right? You want to keep as Mexican as possible, keep speaking Spanish at home, you know, not change a lot of things about your identity, because first and foremost, you're Mexican, and you don't want to be seen as too American, because being, you know, American might hurt you in the long run, that you stop to be, you know, Mexican or whatever ethnicity you're from. And so women are often accused of of not safeguarding those situations for the family.
Would you care to comment, and it's okay if you choose not to, in your experience, in your professional experience, what is the root? What is at the root of this? How would you even label it, this phenomena of women bashing and making women, Latino women specifically, the scapegoats for the assimilation into the American psyche and the American way of life?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that there's one specific, you know, item that I, or thing that I could identify as the root of that. But I mean, I would say that we live within a patriarchal system that allows that has put in place a system, an infrastructure where women are always going to be subjugated to judgment, right? To a controlled behavior. And expected to act and perform in a very specific way. And when they don't follow those parameters, then immediately they're chastised or criticized or ostracized from communities, you know, whether it is by the men, but also by society, that also a lot of times includes other women or other peers, right, who are in that same system. And it's because, you know, our system is set up that way.
This is a topic that I've covered over the years in this podcast with different researchers and different thought leaders. And you're absolutely right in that machismo, patriarchal society, that ethos is hard to overcome even in modern day. The great irony is that the Mexican philosophy is totally based on worshiping women. Look at the Virgen de Guadalupe.
Yeah, I mean, you would say that even then, worshiping the Virgen de Guadalupe is still following a patriarchal system because, you know, Christianity is still based on a patriarchal format, right? You have the image of the father, right? And
yes.
The Virgin is, right? We know it, right? And so, we still have a lot of those patterns, but it's really hard for us to see it on a regular, like, day-to-day basis. And so that's why, like, studying the crónicas for me was extremely valuable, because when you read a crónica, they are very, very funny and engaging. And this is, you know, the ones that I was working from that were published in newspapers at a time when the newspaper was probably like the main source of entertainment for many families, where we know, like, you know, maybe fathers would read the newspaper to the entire family, you know, and then maybe they would read these crónicas where, like, a husband would be like, you know, would maybe, like, you know, punish his wife for not feeding him, you know, chicharrones and enchiladas, you know, and was maybe wanting to feed him ham and eggs, right? And so when you have those narratives still inculcated in a system that is really funny and really engaging, we kind of, you know, internalize those things and don't question them and think that it's okay, right? So that's why I feel like, even though in contemporary times we can say we're evolving, you know, these are things that we shouldn't be, you know, these are roles that we shouldn't be performing, but we still, you know, fall into those systems because that's our infrastructure.
You can still say the unspoken things through music, through art, and through humor.
Yes.
If you can't say it openly and directly, you can use one of those mediums to be able to say what is sociably unacceptable.
Yeah.
And that worked in print media when it was still the only way to get news about what's happening in your community and the world. So I can totally identify with that. I remember that reading the newspaper was the staple of your entertainment, of your information in the morning. And so you take a literary critic. And that was a staple of men's entertainment, a daily staple to find humor in putting down women. Mm-hmm. Sad, but true. Now, tell us about Arte Público Press and some of the breakthroughs that you have led there in order to create a positive narrative or to direct the conversation in the way that it could be or should be to be able to change some of these stereotypes?
Sure. So Arte Público began in 1973 at the Revista Chicanorriqueña, and this was, you know, directed and founded by Dr. Nicolás Canelos, who is, you know, who's still here at the University of Houston. And the goal for the for this magazine, right, that eventually evolves into Arte Público, is to create a space, a physical space, from which Chicanos and New Yorkers can publish, right? Create this physical space, because at that time in the 70s, there were some magazines, there were some avenues for publication, but many were only publishing a few Chicano and New Yorker writers, and it wasn't being done in a respectful and categorical like strong manner, right? So the magazine comes into existence to become this space where these writers can publish, narrative, poetry, theater, and then also artists were included in the publication. So there was a feature by an artist, and the magazine also included literary scholarship. At that moment, still in the 70s, we have to think about where, you know, universities were not allowing graduate students and faculty to publish and to write on any research on Latino writers or, you know, Hispanic writers from the U.S. because that wasn't considered worthy research, right, for their dissertations or for tenure, etc. So the magazine is serving as this space, right, where this is happening. As a result, in the, you know, 7 years later in 1980, when Arte Público, you know, publishes its first book, actually 1979, La Carreta Made a U-Turn, because there had been so much activity, you know, happening with Revista Chicanorriqueña, they had, you know, they were publishing all the writers that we now know, you know, Pat Mora, you know, Lorna Di Cervantes, Miguel Piñero, Tato Laviera they began to see that there is a need to publish more extensive work on them. And so they create, with the Arte Público Press is created to become like a publishing house for Latinos. So any writer who identifies themselves as a Latino, who is writing from the U.S. in English or in Spanish, has the opportunity to publish with the press. And so since that moment on, the press has been making sure that we are making, publishing this work in English or in Spanish and making this material available to a readership where Latinas and Latinos can see themselves reflected in the literature they read. We have some of the initiatives that we have launched are, for instance, the Piñata imprint that in the 1990s began to publish books for children bilingually and for young adults as well, where children are now seeing themselves reflected in the literature that they're reading. With translations or in an original language that is fully reflective of their experience. So, for example, if a book from San Antonio uses the word troca, we're not going to go and change it into camioneta, right? Because that wouldn't be reflective of the community that is being represented in that book with what is now being called an authentic, you know, translation, right? Also, another important thing that we have done since I've been with the press is we have always been at the forefront of publishing works by women, Latina women, right? In recovery, making sure that we're recovering all of these voices by Latinas that were in existence and were maybe not are no longer available, identifying them, making those books available to general audiences. But also in terms of contemporary work, we have published, I think, the most Latinas than any other publisher in the U.S. has done. I think we published over 275 Latino writers. And then lastly, one of the last things that I've done myself is we have created a Center for U.S. Latino Digital Humanities, where we are now taking the work. Our books really were only made available just in print, and also, you know, digitally through Amazon and other different, you know, spaces where these books are made available. But through the digital humanities, we are now also making accessible archival materials, books that are open access, right, to general audiences, free of use, in creating digital exhibits of all the, of many of the materials that we have here at Arte Público in Recovery that are now easily accessible through visualizations that you can see on your phone.
When you say recovery, what do you mean by that?
So by recovery, thanks for asking that. So recovery is the term that we use to refer to the recovery in the U.S. Hispanic Literary Heritage Program.
Ah, gotcha. Yeah. Gotcha. Yes. I first got to know about Arte Público Press because the then, I guess, public figure spoke at the Latino Book Festival that was it was either created around the Houston Chronicle. No, we were a media partner. We were a media partner, and I heard a presentation from the gentleman. I forget his name. Nicola. This was 1985. Mm-hmm. So he was encouraging writers because I'm a writer. I just finished writing my third book. And he was encouraging writers to focus on children's books as the up-and-coming demand for public writers, for authors. I should have listened to him. But that's neither here nor there. And since then, I've had brushes with different people from Arte Público Press. And this is very encouraging to hear you say this, that you guys are publishing Latinas that are finding their voice, that they have the space to be able to tell their story.
Mm-hmm.
To what seems to be the genre of these stories, Dr. Baeza?
Pretty much everything we publish, you know, we publish narrative, you know, short stories, novels, poetry. We don't do as much poetry as you know as we would like, but we, you know, we do a lot of like cuentos for children. We've done some anthologies where, you know, the writers come in and then do a variety of work. A lot of creative fiction, like creative memoirs, right? That includes the narrative mixed with the poetry as well.
Yes, that's very interesting. Is Arte Público Press accepting query letters from authors, Latinas or Latinos that hear this podcast?
Absolutely.
Or, what is the process for submitting a query letter or a manuscript?
So you basically go to our artepublicopress.com, and then you go to our About page, and on there, there's a section where it says for submissions, and then you can submit your query letter there. We are, I think, maybe one of a handful of publishers that accepts unagented manuscripts, and we have, you know, open submission process. So yeah, so if you feel that you have a story that you want to share with us that you would like for us to consider, I do highly encourage you to look to before you submit to us and to any other publisher, to make sure that you look at the catalog, right, of the types of works that are being published, because for instance, we really only publish nonfiction, fiction. The nonfiction that we publish is usually included within specific programs that we have, such as the Hispanic Civil Rights series. And those books are usually done by scholars, by historians, or people who have been doing that type of work on leading figures from the Hispanic Civil Rights movement. But yeah, it's mostly fiction that we publish. And when you submit a query to us, to any publisher, you should always, you know, indicate why your book, you know, why your book should be published by Arte Público, and how does it fit in? How does it fit within all the other books that we are publishing? Because you never want to publish your book in isolation of what everything else that's being published, right? Because your book has to be marketed within the systems that the press already has. So you want to make sure that you are, you know, that you are aware of the writers who we have been publishing for the past 45 years.
You're listening to Latinos Who Thrive with special guest Dr. Baeza Ventura. We'll be right back. Are you ready to unlock your full potential and embark on a journey of limitless knowledge and boundless creativity? Look no further than Wizard Academy, where dreams become reality. At Wizard Academy, they are not just a school. They're a community of visionaries, dreamers, and achievers. Whether you're a student, a working professional, or someone looking to reinvent yourself, Wizard Academy has a place for you. I know because I'm a graduate of the World Changers class of 2007 when I worked in print media. Imagine being guided by industry experts where innovation knows no bounds and where your passions are transformed into skills. Their cutting-edge programs span technology, business, arts, and more. You'll discover the magic within you and you wield it with confidence. At Wizard Academy, they embrace diversity and creativity, and they celebrate your unique journey. So be sure to join them in the heart of innovation, where the extraordinary becomes ordinary. Visit them at www.wizardacademy.org now to explore their lineup of courses, faculty, and the incredible success stories of this community. Your future is waiting. Unleash your inner wizard today. We now return you to Latinos Who Thrive with Dr. Baeza Ventura. Tell us, what are like a couple of runaway bestsellers that our listeners might know that Arte Público Press was responsible for publishing?
Well, yeah, one of the first ones, of course, is The House on Mango Street by Sandra Cisneros. We also published Rain of Gold by Victor Villaseñor. We published some of the early works that by Ana Castillo, who's a very important Chicana writer. We published the plays of Dolores Prida, who was the lead and the editor of Latina magazine, right, in the early 90s and in 2000s. We published all the plays by Luis Valdez, Suit, Luis Valdez is the writer of the playwright for La Bamba, right, and the producer of La Bamba. Uh-huh. And right now in the works we have a memoir by Eduardo Aguirre, who is a former ambassador, U.S. ambassador. So and most recently for children we published the book From Farm Worker to Astronaut by Jose Hernandez, who also had a story about a film made on his life for by Amazon in Prime.
Yes, I'm going to hear him speak next Friday.
Yeah, he's fabulous. Yeah. We've had a lot of one other person that I should be remiss in mentioning, just because his work is just incredibly amazing, and it's Rolando Hinojosa Smith, who documented through a series of nine novels, he really documented the history and the life of the border through his Cronicon on El Valle. He was from Mercedes, Texas, and he wrote about two kids that grew up in El Valle, Texas, and how they grew up, and one goes into the army, and the other one goes on to become a professor at UT Austin.
Is it fiction or is it true?
It's fiction. It's fiction.
Okay. I was going to say, I just finished reading, I just finished doing a study for a policy organization about the culture of the Rio Grande Valley. And that's what piqued my curiosity about this particular author. Because let's talk for a few minutes. I could nerd out with you for the rest of our time, but I really want our listeners to get something of value from our conversation and to really understand the culture and the history and why they need to know this. What would you say, Dr. Baeza?
So I think most importantly in my role also as a professor here at the University of Houston is mostly to to help our general audiences understand that Latinos, the history of Latinos in the U.S. is very complex, and each in Latinidad is highly complex, right? When all the stereotypes that are created around our community are so hurtful because it doesn't, they don't take into consideration the complexities of who we are and how we have a lived experience in the U.S. So, for instance, we must know that one of the first European language that is spoken in the U.S. is Spanish, right? And that happens with Alvar Núñez Cabeza de Vaca in the 1500s, right? When he writes La Relación, he travels like all the way through to New Mexico, right? And begins to document the flora, the fauna, the lived experiences of the indigenous communities that he's encountering. And so oftentimes we are told that we don't have a history here, that we don't belong, right? That we must speak, you know, English, right? And that Spanish doesn't belong in these spaces. Well, on the contrary, right? It does belong because it is precisely that language that was used to name and to identify and to begin to give us a sense of who and what we are now. Latinos lived in Mexicanos, and were people of Spanish, indigenous, and Mexican, mestizo, these that lived in this territory that we now know as the U.S. before the U.S. Took over. And so a lot of those sections, you know, here in Texas and California, oftentimes we forget that, you know, that there was a treaty that was signed that gave all of those citizens, those people that stay there, the right to become full-fledged citizens. And those rights were almost immediately removed, right, and violated. And so that creates a sense of remorse, of anger, right, in communities that were displaced and mistreated and placed in a position of a second-class citizens. The same thing, you know, happened with Puerto Rico. And so I think once we begin to understand all of these complexities, then we begin to see that Latinos are integral to the culture and the makeup of U.S. Americans. And to me, that's extremely valuable. And that we also understand the role that Spanish has played in the making, you know, in the making of our nation, and how, you know, it is a language that just like we work very hard at keeping other languages within our communities, we should really strive to make sure that language, you know, that and understand that Spanish has been used as a target, right, to harm our communities. There is so much linguistic and cultural violence, perpetrated against our communities that we now have, second generations, afraid to speak Spanish, or, you know, because they might get reprimanded or they might not be successful. And so in return, right, they lose their Spanish, and then they're not able to connect with their immediate communities, with their abuelitos. You know, they can go back to their home countries because they also don't feel that they belong anymore. And so I think, you know, understanding all those complexities would help us understand how Latinos are a community that just by existence, right, they're performing an act of social justice, right? That they're confronting systems where they are not necessarily they're confronting systems that usually don't want them in there, that they're not imagined for them, right? If they don't want to imagine those communities and those spaces. And so it's hard to participate.
I have lived through that. I've lived through a lot of that. Yeah. I am a boomer, and I want to ask you, you use the word Chicano, Chicana.
Yeah.
That is going out of style. And as the newer generations prefer Latinx or Hispanic and other labels, why do you think it's important to have the proper description of a person of color?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think in those descriptions to me really come from the individuals themselves, right? And like, for instance, when I was growing up in Ciudad Juarez and El Paso, I was always told I was Mexican first, you know, and I always,
yes.
you know, I was Mexican, and then later on I became Mexican American, and then I became Hispanic by the space in which I was, by the environment in which I was living. And then when I went to study at the University of New Mexico and was fully, you know, involved in understanding Chicanismo, I understood that I too was a Chicana, right? That I too, you know, there were some shared experiences that were part of also of my identity. And then later on, you know, moving out of those spaces and, you know, and going to conferences and reading a lot more, I came into the term of Latino and Latinidad. And so, and that also became part of a term that I think, you know, that represents me as well. And so I think as Latinos, it's important for us to understand what each of these terms mean. You know, yeah, I agree that Chicano may not be a term that we use, you know, that is as present as it was, you know, maybe even like 10 years ago. But it is still a term that is so much needed, because we need to understand that legacy, and the legacy for civil rights, right, for justice that was fought by a group of kids, right, a youth that empowered themselves through a term that was used against them, right, in order for them to empower themselves and defend the rights for many of us that many of us are enjoying. And so Chicano for me becomes a term that is now an ideology, right, that also represents me as well. And I think it's crucial that we understand why some of these terms are valid and useful in certain spaces, right? And
I love it. The pejorative became a code of honor.
Exactly, right? Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. That leads us to the award that you were recently awarded, the BANIF Award. Tell us about that. How did that come about?
Yeah, so that's it's an amazing award that came through the city of Houston. Sixto Wagon here at, let me make sure that I have his, I make sure how to pronounce his last name. Sixto Wagon, he's a project director of the BIPOC Arts Network here in the Houston area, and they received a grant to give funding to communities of color, especially local communities of color here in the Houston area, that after the pandemic, right, were in the like on the verge of losing, you know, their organizations, or the, you know, they were in a precarious situation. And,
which I might add that it took years for them to establish themselves. And just at the point that they were barely sustainable, they would be erased. Houston would be a totally different place if those different nonprofit organizations had disappeared. So this is big for Arte Público Press to be among the recipients of that grant money to be able to keep going. What else happened for Arte Público Press to receive this award?
So we were recognized as one of the treasures that exist here in the Houston area, and an organization that for the past 45 years has been doing important work in making literature available for children, for young adults, for adults. And so the award comes, you know, with some money that allows us to secure funding to continue to do a lot of the programming that we have been doing for the past 45 years. It allows us to work on the transition between the director and founder of Arte Público, who's Dr. Nicolás Canelos, and myself, so that I can, you know, come in and take the lead next September 2025. And it gives us an opportunity to begin to showcase and think about, not only think about, but begin to restructure our marketing plan so that we do become, you know, an organization that is nationally and locally. Well, nationally we are known, but a lot of oftentimes locally we're not as, you know, as recognized as we should be.
Why do you think that's the case? Because I totally concur with you. It's like every Latino in Houston should know who Arte Público Press is and why they need to read, why they need to follow everything that your organization is doing, And more importantly, why they need to support Arte Público Press. Why is that?
Right. I'm not sure why, you know, here in the Houston area, it's difficult for us to, I mean, I have the, one thing that comes to mind is that perhaps we still haven't been fully included in the Houston Independent School District, for example, or in some of the other school districts, precisely
it's
because
cultural politics.
Yeah, it's all
we're
yeah.
back to cultural politics, and I'm moving that space, and I'm raising my voice. As a matter of fact, my business partner and I are doing a cultural intelligence summit at HCC next month, because things have to change in getting out and speaking to different groups. We are in a crisis of our Latino children that they are not being totally educated on a cultural narrative that builds their self-esteem and their identity.
Absolutely right. I agree with that. You know, we in Latino literature in general, it's not imagined within these like historical and cultural, you know, national narratives. We, you know, we're not featured in those spaces. And so, so here in Houston, a lot of times, you know, we are within the University of Houston, but we're not, you know, we're a program within the University of Houston, but we're not like the university's publishing house. And so I don't know if maybe because we're under that bigger umbrella, it's hard for people to see us, or just people are not, you know, seeing, you know, the literature that we're publishing. But nationally, we are, you know, people are you know, buying our books, they're seeking us out. They, you know, our writers are getting, you know, reviews. But it's, you know, we're still working within a framework that is still very that is still working from a position of a lot of power, and where Latinos are not always, you know, seen as actors within those spaces.
Yes. I remember the mythology working at the Houston Chronicle that Latinos don't read. I was at a conference, and somebody had the audacity to say from the stage that Latinos don't read. I got up and I said, "Excuse me, sir, but that's a total myth. Latinos in Latin America used to read, because this is, again, I'm dating myself to the days of the newspaper. They read at least four newspapers, four dailies, okay? And I went on to work at the Houston Business Journal, and we were in a meeting. We were in an advertising meeting, and somehow the topic came up of Latinos, and I said, well, Latinos are the number one reader of the Houston Business Journal. So my manager looked at me as though I had a third eye and said, "Where did you get that?" I said, "Our own independent study of who our readership is told us that, because I just read it." She didn't even know that Latinos were the number one demographic to read the Houston Business Journal. Imagine that. And this was an Anglo, by the way. Okay.
Yeah.
This was an Anglo manager.
Yeah. Well, you know, in the work that we've done, that we did through the recovery program, we documented that there were approximately 2,000 newspapers published in Spanish. By Spanish speakers in the U.S. between the 1800s and 1980,
repeat again, please.
So that there were approximately 2,000 newspapers published, you know, by Spanish speakers in the U.S. Right?
Okay.
From 1811, which is the first one, which is called El Mississippi, to 1980.
Okay.
You know, that's a lot of newspapers being published for a community that was, like you said, like highly receptive to these newspapers. You know, and publishing a newspaper is not an easy feat, and you have
the numbers today.
Today, I'm not sure what those numbers are. I could probably like pull them up for you, but
because I can tell you that in Houston, the fourth largest city in the country, all the Spanish newspapers are gone, save two. La Voz, which is on the on its deathbed, which I work for them. La Voz, the Houston of the Houston Chronicle, and Que Onda Magazine, which I'm a senior writer for them. Those are the only two newspapers. All the others are Shoppers. They're not newspapers.
Yeah.
So we are in a crisis of Latinos not having proper news and information that is by Latinos for Latinos.
Right. And it's, and you know, again, and it's the infrastructure that makes those systems, those items available to the community, that a lot of times they function as gatekeepers, right? In the publishing industry, we have, you know, the reviewers and the editors at other larger publishing houses, the distributors, who a lot of times may not, because they're not aware, right? Or they don't, you know, they're not aware of the needs of the community, or they don't care to be aware of those needs. They don't pick up the books, you know. So, I mean, if we look at the way the bookstores function, right? The bookstores will only receive books that they think they'll
commercial.
Right? Or that their distributor thinks that they're gonna sell.
Yes.
Right? Depending on their audiences. And so if our audiences are not going to seek those books out at those bookstores, then they'll think that those community members don't live in those areas, right? Where those books should be. And so
we're fighting the gatekeepers as well as the supply and demand side of reading. Yeah, sad. On a positive side, I do want to end to give our listeners some hope, because one of my clients was just approached or he made a deal to publish through Simon & Schuster a book that chronicles his story, his Latino story of highs and lows in establishing himself as a business entrepreneur here in the Houston market. And the publisher told him that they are interested in publishing other Latino stories. So that was good news for me to hear that Simon & Schuster, one of the biggest publishing houses, was interested in publishing this genre of books.
Yeah, that's absolutely wonderful, and we want more publishing houses to continue to do this work. We urge them, you know, to do it, and most importantly, we urge them to do it from a, you know, in a sensitive and responsible way, you know, where we continue to respect and honor the stories as they are told in the languages in which they are told, without editing the
not scrubbed and homogenized to where it's Americanized.
Right. Exactly. So that the readers, right? Because then reviewers will say, like, you know, one time we published a book where there was no piñata mentioned, you know, and one of the reviewers said, oh, I wish the piñata would have been there. And I said, well, why? Like, there's no reason to put a piñata, you know, in a space where the piñata is not needed. But that's, again, you know, a lot of times the reviewers and the readers of Latino literature who are not familiar or are not willing to even explore our culture really want to receive the stereotype. And that's where it's crucial to understand the importance and the significant work that comes out of a publishing house such as ours, right? Where we continue to push for those boundaries to make sure that Latinos are respected, right? For what they have to say, for how they are saying it. Right. And the characters and the stories that are being, you know, shared out about the community, so that hopefully we begin to understand how complex and beautiful our Latino community is.
Yes. I want to ask you one final question and I'll get your final comment. This is a cultural thing. Were you a fan of Chico's Tacos?
100%. Of course.
I hated them when I first ate them, and they kind of grew on me after eating them for 10 years.
Now you go back for them all the time?
Yeah, I never realized that I would miss Chico's Tacos.
They're El Paso staple, and you can't ever say that you experienced any specific amount of time in El Paso if you didn't try the Chico's Tacos.
Yes, there you have it, readers or listeners. If you ever go to El Paso, you gotta stop into a Chico's Tacos and have what they consider the world's best tacos. It is quite. There's a whole story behind it, but that's a conversation for another day. Any final words, Dr. Baeza?
No, well, yes, absolutely. There's please follow us on social media. You know, we're on Facebook, and like our post. Feel free to reach out to us if you have any questions about publishing, if you have any suggestions for any stories. But we invite you to visit our website to look at the books that we've published, the different programs that we have, the recovery program, as well as our U.S. Latino Digital Humanities Center, so that you can see some of the archival materials that we are working from. And please recommend our books, buy our books. Remember, the more books that we sell, we're a fully nonprofit. So the more books that we sell, the more books that we get to print. And don't forget to read tonight, 30 minutes a day.
Yes, the supply side. You can do something positive by purchasing a book from Arte Público Press to immerse yourself in literature that is worth reading, not the stuff that rots your brain on social media. Well, there you have it, friends. Another great guest. And that's going to do it for today. Until next week, go out and thrive.